Welcome to the Book Spider podcast, where me and my co-hosts discuss a book and try to analyze it and its themes in light of the other books that we've read recently for the podcast. My name is Chris Malmberg. I'm joined today by my co-hosts, Patrick Barney and Hans Berger. And today we're going to be discussing If on a Winter's Night, a Traveler, by Italo Calvino. And a brief summary of what If on a Winter's Night, a Traveler is about. If on a Winter's Night, a Traveler is about you, the reader sitting down to read If on a Winter's Night, a Traveler, but you find a printing error that doesn't reveal any of the text beyond page 32. You go to the bookshop, but they have no complete copy of the text. They do suggest that perhaps the printing error was so extensive that the story may continue in a completely different book, or even that the copy you had didn't contain If on a Winter's Night, a Traveler at all. You buy a copy of the book outside the town of Malbork in the hopes that the misprint continues the original story in there. You also meet a woman named Ludmilla at the bookstore, who's also trying to read If on a Winter's Night, a Traveler, and who also picks up outside the town of Malbork in order to try and finish it, and you decide to pursue her. It turns out that the outside the town of Malbork is a completely different story that ends also just when it's just about to get interesting. Your desire to find the ends to both novels leads you down a path of increasing fragmentation as you discover the beginnings to 8 more novels that themselves, too, have no endings. You also pursue Ludmilla, briefly find yourself replaced by Ludmilla as the you in the novel, read Ludmilla and get read by Ludmilla, and eventually marry Ludmilla. You also uncover the conniving force behind the endless novels. That's a pun there, right? Endless novels in the form of Marana, a translator who has so thoroughly sabotaged the publishing industry that no one can be sure which parts of any given book truly belong anywhere. You're also imprisoned briefly by a repressive foreign government, where you have sex with a police officer who may also be a revolutionary, who may also be a counter-revolutionary, who may also be Ludmilla's sister. In the end, you find a library that purports to have all 10 of the novels you've so far started but not had a chance to finish, but of course it doesn't have them. Instead, someone you meet there overhears the titles of the novels you're seeking and says that, read one after another, they sound very much like the beginning of a novel they read once. So, it's really complicated, and luckily I have with me two brilliant explicators of complicated fiction, Hans Berger and Patrick Barney, to suss through the various questions that I have about this novel. Those questions are, what might If on a Winter's Night, a Traveler say about our relationships to the texts in our lives, literal and figurative, and how our faith in the fidelity of those texts might or might not pitch us into spiraling shit fits of despair? I also have a question about an interpretation of a critic's take on If on a Winter's Night, a Traveler, basically that Calvino is reacting to the modern methods by which texts are interpreted through various theoretical lenses, and that If on a Winter's Night, a Traveler is trying to sort of subvert that desire for interpreting texts into meaning. And, you know, whether you agree with that, whether you have your own take on what the novel means. I have a question about how the tension between storyteller, interpreters, storyteller, fabricator, and reader manifests in the novel's portrayal of politics, especially with that repressive government and the repressive police state that it depicts, its portrayal of men and women and of sex. And I'm also curious to hear if we have any time to go into any of the fragments in particular, because this is a very fragmented novel. It is basically structured such that the story of you is proceeding as a kind of a frame that's woven around the beginnings of these novels that you have a chance to pick up and read throughout the book. And again, there are 10 of those, and I think, 11 chapters about you outside of those fragments. So it's very fragmented. It's very meta. It's very confusing. And I'll start by asking Patrick and Hans whether you liked it.
Well, yeah, I liked it a lot. This is actually the third time that I've read this novel. It's funny. There's at the beginning of, I think on pretty maybe like the second or third page, there's a reference to all the different kinds of books that are in a bookstore. And one of the types of books in the bookstore is books that you pretend to have read but have not read. And this actually was that for a while for me. I had a class in undergrad where we basically, it was kind of a dream syllabus for me for how my tastes would have evolved a few years later. And I didn't know that at the time. So I was really broke and having some relationship issues. And so I pretended to read a bunch of things that I hadn't even bought. I don't know how I got through the class. But this was one of those books. And a couple years later, I did eventually buy it and read it just to kind of try to make up for that. And I don't remember much about how I felt about it then, but I read it a second time, oh, probably 3 or 4 years ago, maybe a bit longer. When I moved in with the woman who's now my wife, she owned a copy of this actually, and I saw it and I thought, I read that back in like 2007 ish. And really didn't like it that much then, and really enjoyed it this time. And I think the difference between the reading where I didn't like it at all and the reading where I really enjoyed it was just that the structure of this podcast, the fact that I was reading it for a context where people would be asking me questions about it, meant that I had to actually pay attention to it and think about it. And I think it's something where if you're just... it's a book where if you're reading it with just a medium level of concentration or interest, it becomes apparent pretty quickly that everything is fragmented, nothing adds up to much, that all the reasons for which we would normally read a book are kind of thrown out the window. And that actually includes things like, subtlety of characterization, or when I say all the things that would make us normally read a book are thrown out the window, I also mean not just like obvious stuff like I identify with this protagonist, I have similar feelings, right? But like all the kind of more, a lot of the things that even a more esoterically minded reader might like. So it's very easy to kind of just kind of, because everything is so fragmentary, because the relationship of this bit to the other bit is uncertain, and it's not clear there is kind of a cumulative relationship of meaning or narrative, it's very easy to just kind of wave your hand and wait for it to be done, right? And kind of just, I think the second time that I read it, I just wanted to kind of get it out of the way after a while. But the other side of that is like there are a lot of really interesting ideas and commentaries and, images. There's a lot of really fun, intriguing stuff that you run into along the way, but it can be challenging to make yourself slow down and pay attention. And I still don't know if they all add up to a cohesive idea or if it's more just kind of like a tour of a series of different ideas about both intellectual ideas about the nature of reading and our relationship to books and more emotional ideas about kind of our, in some ways it's kind of a tribute to the experience of reading, right? But it's also a tribute in a very haphazard way. And it's almost like, that like train imagery is pretty, is recurring. And it's almost like being on a train, looking out the window and getting like, brief glimpses of all these different either kind of essayistic ideas about the emotional nature of reading or theoretical ideas about the nature of texts, and they all just kind of whiz by on the train, and then the book is over, you know.
Yeah, I'll admit there are some of these stories, you know, a few of the 10 that I'm would be that I think went in one ear and out another almost. I did listen to this novel, but I think even if I was reading it on the page, I know some would just stick with me more than others, and without that cohesive sense of plot to kind of hold the whole thing together, it's it does feel a bit like maybe intentional that happens. I don't know if it's I don't know if it's intentional or not, but it definitely is something I'm conscious of, having only read it once. Some of these fragments, I don't know if I remember very well at all. So,
yeah. And the stories, you know, the first chapters, a part of the conceit is that the reader is really invested in that story by the time the first chapter ends. Not all of these are actually, they don't really seem like they're, there's almost kind of like an ironic effect there where a lot of them really don't seem like they are actually written to be that gripping, right? Some more than others, but anyway, Patrick?
I definitely thought there were some interesting parts and interesting ideas. The whole idea of this country, Sumeria, and like the study of Sumeria, that was kind of neat. Ultimately, I would say that, like, I probably didn't really enjoy it, and that it could have been much, much shorter. It seemed to me like it could have achieved a similar effect and been much shorter. So, like, to be honest, like, I wouldn't say that, like, I loathed it the way I did Waterland. Like, Waterland, I actively loathed. This, I just found mostly boring and incomprehensible.
All right.
How did you feel about it, Chris?
Did I feel about it?
Did you regret choosing it?
I did not. I feel like I went through stages of being really enamored with it, and then actually kind of resenting it, I think. yeah, I think that's sure. Not too strong of a word. There was a couple fragments where I just didn't care about anything that was going on, whether that's intentional or not. I think like this kind of like postmodern criticism of you know, writers mixing different forms or writing outside of their normal mode, like Nabokov and Pale Fire and the poem, and whether or not the poem is supposed to be really good or just kind of good, and I don't know if all of these stories are Italo Calvino flexing and saying like, look, I can write in all these different styles with all these different, you know, motifs and have them all be really good, or if there's some sort of, you know, I don't know what his intentions were, and I'd have to read it again to really evaluate some of the ones that didn't stick with me, but yeah, there was a couple times when I really was a little bit resentful of it, but I think ultimately it captured me with just how, I don't know, it. It's so sure of what it wants to do, and in the end, I enjoyed it. So I think probably I'm in the middle between you two. I definitely don't feel like I made a mistake picking it. I'm glad I read it. I think I need to read it again. is If on a Winter's Night a Traveler a novel about how there is something insoluble, maybe the word, undissolvable between a reader and a book that no forces, be they Marana's or repressive governments, can reach or influence. And
if it is that, it's wrong.
It's wrong? You say, Patrick, why?
I mean, this is just jibber jabber. It's not fucking real. None of it has anything to do with anything that is worthwhile or meaningful or interesting, and it's just a pseudo problem. Like, sometimes you can't get a grip of a text and you don't know what it means and there's nothing to do, and other times you can, and that's it, you know. Like, it's if the novel is doing what you're saying it's doing, then it's just like philosophizing into the wind. That's my take.
I think that I guess, like, when I, and I'm I don't know that I can respond to Patrick's comment directly there. I think
you could.
It's perfectly reasonable to say that this is philosophizing into the wind, first of all. I actually don't have any disagreement with that at all, right? To talk about it any further, we probably just have to accept that and...
Right.
You know.
You're right. You're absolutely right. My attitude is not... Like, that. It's not a... That's an attitude about, like, it's propositions about the real world... And it's not exactly conducive to a, like, analysis of the text. So I know what you're saying.
Yeah, I mean, it's not, you know, telling us something about the plight of indigenous Americans, right? It's not telling us about, you know, all the structural flaws of capitalism. And that's, you know, I mean... I think the books that we look at on this podcast, you know, there's like a sliding scale where some are intensely real world relevant and poignant in that regard, and others have their head up their own ass. And I don't think it's unreasonable to say this is about as far toward the end of got its head up its own ass as anything we've looked at. I have no problem with that at all, right? Like, I don't. What I was going to say, though, is, I mean, I think, Chris, like, this struck me as essentially a love letter to reading, right? It's, I don't know that it's, your question was, does it propose an indissoluble relationship between the reader and the text that nothing can come between? I don't know if I would precisely say that. I think it certainly proposes a relationship of love between Italo Calvino and the text that no one can come between, right? It's mm-hmm. essentially a whole series of perspectives on the relationship of the reader to the book. And one of the very few consistent things here is how all these characters, regardless of their theoretical perspectives about reading, they really care about it, right? They love it. And they're very interested in the act of reading. That's true of the second person protagonist. It's true of Ludmilla. It's, you know, it's true of the Irish author that spies on the woman reading with the telescope. It's, I mean, I think that it, if I were to make a case for the, I think the best case that I can make kind of for the real world relevance of this book would just essentially be that it's, you know, it's written by someone who really loves fiction and reading, and it's about that in many kind of manifold, bizarre, I don't want to say twisted because that's not the most articulate choice of words, but through all the different funhouse mirrors, it kind of still is ultimately about many different perspectives on that relationship. You know, we've talked a little bit about totalitarianism. There's a sequence in here with a a person, if I remember right, a man who works as a censor for a totalitarian government, right? And he says, you know, I read these books mm-hmm. two ways, right? I read them quickly once to ascertain whether or not they need to be banned. And then the ones that should be banned, I take them home and I savor them, right? Or he doesn't take them home. He, like, reads them in, like, a special chamber that he has in the fortress of the totalitarian government. And you can kind of make, you can make whatever point you want to about what that says about the nature of totalitarianism. And it's, I'm sure that, you know, I'm sure that there's some version of that censor in real life, right? I mean, I don't know why this example comes to mind, but, like, when they captured bin Laden, he had a bunch of porn, right? You know, people who are, people who work in the apparatus of repression are still just as susceptible as anybody else to, you know, the pleasures of a good book or a good wank or whatever, you know?
Right.
And there's some kind of statement there, but more than anything else, again, I think that that's just kind of like one more way of thinking about, as you mentioned it, Chris, the relationship of the reader to the book. And I don't, I mean, clearly that relationship is not indissoluble because, you know, Hermes Marana has prevented the poor second person protagonist from getting more than a chapter into anything, right? So he's repeatedly dissolved that relationship just as a matter of logistics. But, I mean, I think it's telling that, you know, it's telling that the second person reader loves all these first chapters, right? He is, and I mean, it is a he is quite omnivorous. And in spite of all the number of, even though, like, he's kind of Charlie Browning and the football, right? Like, the football keeps being pulled away and he keeps falling down, but every time somebody holds up the football of attempting first chapter, he runs for it again, right? And there's something very sweet about that kind of that persistence in the joy of reading in spite of, you know, repeated whacks in the nuts. There's just something very very charming about that. Again, I mean, these are all, you know, I don't know that it necessarily addresses any even theoretical problems. It ultimately just seemed to me like it's about the joy of reading.
How does, you know, earlier I said that, like, I felt like maybe this should be a short story or something. And I was wondering what this book does. That, say, a Borges short story doesn't do, like in this long form version versus, because it seemed to me that, like, while reading this book, that, like, a lot of similarities between mm-hmm. Calvino's work and Borges' work came up to me. Like, specifically the Cimmerian thread that I talked about earlier seems very similar to Borges' story, Talon, Ukbar, and Orbis Tertius. You know, like thinking about these fictional places as if they are real. And, you know, Hans, you say this is about the love of reading, or like a major thread is about the love of reading. And, you know, I don't necessarily know if I saw that. And I'm just wondering, like, whatever it is trying to do besides make, you know, contentious claims about the relationship between human being and texts, what is it doing that needs to make it, you know, 200 pages or 250 pages or whatever?
That's a really good question. I mean, like, I think, like, what, I mean, maybe there's a parallel question that can help us, like, talk about it, which is, like, what makes a novel? And I don't remember who it was. It was, like, Francine Prose or Baxter or one of them,
Baxter.
You know, talking about the shagginess of a novel. You know, short stories and novellas are organized, you know, around a kind of they're organized within a very intentional silhouette, whereas a novel has a kind of a shagginess that allows it to reach in many more directions at once.
Right.
And maybe that is part of it. Though I think we sort of sabotaged the question that I tried to ask too, is that this novel does seem to invite a lot of abstraction, you know, to try and interpret in many different ways, but then it's so faceted and it has so many different things going on, and so many different styles, you know, like noir and political thriller and on and on and on, that it kind of resists that. And maybe that's a part of its shagginess.
So it needs to be longer. It needs to be longer. It needs to be shaggier so that it can emulate more styles and invoke more reader text relationships to reveal its desire to show us how much we love reading or I'm trying to be charitable.
One of the assumptions that's built into the premise of your question is that I think your question is premised on you not liking any individual page of this novel that much, right?
Like, fair enough.
The question is premised on the idea that the text should be goal-oriented, right? That it should come in and make its point and get out, and that there's no reason for it to take 200 pages to come in and make its point and get out if it couldn't make basically a similar point in 50 pages, right? And
yeah, I mean, I think that's probably something I would say I like texts to do, be goal-oriented.
Sure, sure. And I mean, I think that one of the assumptions of this book is that someone who's reading it will just naturally find it amusing to see Calvino do 10 different brief genre riffs, right? But the idea of, like, okay, now Calvino's going to do this Japanese sex comedy that's, you know, very based around this incredibly mannered sort of expression of lust. I think if you don't find the basic idea of Calvino riffs on uptight Japanese sex comedy, if that just by the nature of its existence doesn't charm you, then, you know.
Well, I mean,
and it might be that, I mean, maybe, you know, if it were Don DeLillo riffing on Japanese sex comedy, maybe you'd enjoy that more, you know. It might, I don't know. But I mean, I think that, like, the premise of your question suggests a kind of goal orientation that is just kind of antithetical to the purpose of the book, right?
Sure.
I do think that certainly, like, to whatever extent it makes points, those points could have been made in 25 pages by Borges because he's great. I agree with that.
Sure. Be clear, the thought of a writer riffing on, like, a mannered Japanese sex comedy, that sounds interesting to me, but that's not what Calvino's doing, right? He is riffing on a bunch of different things in a bunch of different ways over the course of 200 pages and is making it, you know, not exactly welcoming for people to just dive in and enjoy the riffing, as far as I'm concerned. I mean, maybe you can argue about that last point, but he's certainly not just riffing on like a funny Japanese sex comedy. He's riffing on a bunch of other things as well. And
well, yeah.
You don't have any sense. I mean, you know, maybe this is all like kind of just like an impasse. Like, I'm not going to enjoy this style of book, and I'm not going to think it's good, and there's probably just nothing to do about that, and I probably just have to accept that.
Well, I mean, I think that your point is a valid one, right? I don't want to dismiss your point. But I also think that, like, there is if page to page to page you don't enjoy reading it, there's a limit to how much we can defend the purpose of its existence.
I was curious, Patrick and Hans, were there fragments that stuck out to you as, you know, more engaging than others? Were you paying more attention or more interested in any sections of the, you know, the story about you, the that frames these fragments? Were there pieces that stuck out?
What was that funny one about, like, there are two novelists and they watch each other from their windows, and one is a novelist who works really well, like he's very productive, and the other one is, as the text says, a tortured novelist who, like, racks his brain and is like everything he produces is an act of arduous labor. I thought that was fairly funny, fairly intriguing. And like, you know, like if I had encountered it as a short story, I would have been more receptive to it. Yeah, so there certainly were portions that I found intriguing, like that one.
It feels like there are pieces that could have been wrapped up and packaged as, you know, several pieces of this novel. It feel, you know, going back to what you were saying, Patrick, about what it is not. It is not Italo Calvino riffing on, noir for the first fragment, or kind of speculative sci-fi fiction for the last fragment. It almost feels as though you could take bits of this and package it up as little short stories that culminate in some sort of, you know, meaningful end. But then in sort of cutting that end off and stringing them all together, it is, it feels a bit like, I think it can feel a bit like he's robbing us of those things, because you mentioned the two authors who are jealous of each other. I was thinking of, just the, there's briefly this exploration of kind of two cult communities that are interested in, I think it's Ernest Marana for different reasons. One, that his apocrypha might uncover, that apocrypha are the true path to a deeper meaning. And then another one that is kind of like converse to that. I can't remember the specifics, but that too felt like it could be that lifted out as a kind of Borgesian, short story, a little interesting clockwork piece.
Right.
And yet, what he's doing is taking all of those, facets that like are almost perfect, but then just like don't include key parts, and then just stitching them to other like facets that are almost perfect, but don't include key parts. And then it is this, you used the word in Messenger, you know, when we were talking about this onanistic
right.
kind of blue balls, like, I just want, I just want the end. I just want what this means. And, that is maybe not totally friendly to the reader, but it is really compelling. Like, I found it very compelling.
Not totally friendly is an understatement. I find that compelling too. I find that quality compelling. And I mean, I think it's hard sometimes. We've talked a little bit about like one, you know, quirk or habit that I have as a reader is if I feel like if I go into a text and I feel like I almost kind of get it, but then I don't, I tend to develop a love relationship to that text, much more so than if I read something and I really kind of connect with everything intellectually and emotionally, right? Like, and I have a very and it might be based on a misunderstanding of what makes works good, right? I mean, I think I've at this point in my life, I'm probably qualified to assert my own understanding of what makes a work good, right? Maybe sure. A misunderstanding is unkind, but like, I feel like if I read this slowly with a notebook and just like, every time I read a paragraph where when I was done, I wasn't sure what it said, I like went back and broke it down. I do feel like there are a lot of ideas and perspectives to unpack here, right? I do also feel like there are things that could have been done to make it more entertaining or to seem more evidently meaningful as a... If you're going to use this device, the device could be done in a more entertaining and a friendly way, right? Like, every time I read this, I look for... I feel like if another author wrote this, there would be more kinds of resonances between the fake first chapters, right? That images or themes or ideas would kind of pop up more often from one to another, where there would be, you know, you would get flashes of connection between them. And I think if you had something like that where there were more repeating ideas or themes between the different first chapters, it would be much easier to feel like it held together as a text. Or like the whole device of like the titles of each of the first chapters, the title of the overall work adds up to a sentence, which is also the first sentence in an overall work. Like, that's kind of a clever idea, except that it results in all of the novels that he reads, that you read, I guess, as the second person protagonist. It results in all those novels having titles that no sane person would ever apply to a novel, right? Like, I'm pretty sure nobody would ever call a novel Looks Down in the Gathering Shadow, right? When you asked about the question of what, when you asked about the question of what stood out to us in memory, very little does stand out to me in memory from the first chapters, right? And a part of the reason is just because they're all called things like, you know, in a network of lines that enlace, right? Like, so he has kind of... Deliberately or otherwise, he's done things that would kneecap the enjoyment even of someone who was actually really enthusiastic about this postmodern meta gimmick, right? Which is both admirable and infuriating. And it's always, I don't know, novels that are in translation, I always consider the possibility that there are aesthetic effects that I am missing from the translation. And it might be that if we knew, I don't know, maybe if you read this in the original, there would be, you know, effects around like stylistic homages, things like that, that would be more appealing. But I'm very fond of this book, but I'm also quite willing to concede that it makes decisions that make it really hard to appreciate.
What, Hans, like following up on all these things that you're talking about, like it's its stylistic choices. Just to connect to last week, like with Timbuktu, you didn't like Timbuktu, which is fine. Like, I get it. There were there were technical problems with the novel. And I wonder, like, why are Timbuktu's problems technical and make it not a good book, whereas this works, you know, like, to me, the idea of a writer making it hard for the reader to get into his work is absolutely a technical failure. So what do you, you know, how would you respond to that? Like, why are Calvino's decisions not technical failures?
I think if I were to read this again carefully, there are ideas and elements of meaning that I could draw from it that I didn't get on the reading that I gave it.
Mm-hmm.
Any of the three times that I've read it. And, you know, that may seem kind of masochistic, I guess, now that I say it. But I think if I read Timbuktu again, I don't think there's anything there I didn't catch, right?
Sure.
My issue with Timbuktu, which for anybody who didn't listen to last episode, Timbuktu by Paul Auster is a novel about a dog whose tramp poet master dies. And the dog has to kind of figure out what to do to, you know, survive. My issue with Timbuktu, at a sentence level, there were lots of things that were nicely written about Timbuktu, right? I think my issue with Timbuktu is that it began as something that worked according to a particular set of narrative devices, and that it completely didn't follow through on what it had established as the goals for the protagonist. And it did so. It failed to meet its own goals. It failed to, you know, kick the ball through the goalposts it had set up in a way that, to me, did not seem to suggest any alternate strategy or deliberate misdirection or any layer of meaning somehow hidden in the failure to follow narrative convention, right?
That's not something we would say about If on a Winter's Night. Like, it doesn't fail on its own terms.
It doesn't fail on its own terms, right? It seemed to me that Timbuktu failed on its own terms, and when you took away the pleasure that would have been offered by success on its own terms, all you were really left with is kind of a, you know, pathetic narrative and a kind of... not much else.
Right. Sure.
Well,
I think that is a good way to wrap it up, right? If On a Winter's Night, a Traveler is success on its own terms, and it does not make
it's not
very
friendly
many concessions to the reader.
Right.
Not necessarily friendly. I definitely admired it and enjoyed a lot of it very, very much, and will read it again. Hans, sounds like you loved it. And Patrick... felt differently.
Yeah, sure.
I don't know if I'd say that I loved it. I do think that I'll probably be rereading it periodically, I would imagine, for the rest of my life, barring some catastrophic change. I kind of also had the urge to make a concept album about it, which is usually a good sign for my relationship to a book. But
just a bunch of songs that don't have any...
Right. It'll be like a minute and a half of a thrash metal song, and then it'll cut out abruptly right before it goes into the best part.
Oh my God. That sounds like torture. Don't make me listen to that, Hans. Don't.
Okay. So it's my turn then to tell you guys what's next. So, boy, Patrick, you might be in for a bad run here. So
that
this
sucks.
I
was hoping for something good this time around.
Yeah, well, the next pick is yours, so you know you can put us back on track then. But
all right.
So I
probably will.
Yeah, I kind of have a personal backstory with the next book, which I don't really have time to get into right now. But it's something that I tried to read a few years ago and wasn't quite able to connect with. And I recently saw it. I was reading a list of the 100 best books of the 20th century that had an awful lot of things I loved. And I thought, well, you know, maybe it's time to give that one another shake. So I've started to reread it. And if nothing else, I can imagine getting to the end of it. And it connects to the Calvino because, you know, this Calvino, If on a Winter's Night a Traveler, is kind of regarded as like one of the great postmodern head fucks, right? And the book that I've chosen for next week is one of the great lost postmodernists. It's someone who for a while was often mentioned in the same breath, regarded as both a peer and a contemporary of Pynchon, DeLillo, all those folks that I adore, but has really, really slipped out of any kind of public recognition. And in fact, you know, you'll probably have to, you know, I don't think there's an audiobook version of this, and it's out of print, very hard to find in paper, so you'll probably have to read it on ebook. But what I've been building up to here is Lookout Cartridge by Joseph McElroy.
Lookout Cartridge, Joseph McElroy.
That's it, yep. And it's a bit long, so if you guys need an extra week, let me know. It's not too hard paragraph by paragraph. There's just a fair amount of it. So,
thanks for joining us, everybody, for this podcast episode on If on a Winter's Night a Traveler by Italo Calvino. Join us next episode for Lookout Cartridge by Joseph McElroy. And I look forward to Patrick squirming even more with
I'll try not
postmodernist
to.
Refusal to mean anything beyond its own play.
I'll try to be more cooperative next time.
You don't have to be. You don't have to be. If you don't, man, Patrick, if you don't like Lookout Cartridge, I will not be unhappy.
Okay. All right.
All right. Talk to you guys
later. All right. Peace out, guys.
Talk to you guys later. Have a good weekend. Yeah. Bye.